Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Red Army during the Russian Civil War. And I think one of the things that's worth talking about here are some of the kind of the ebbs and flows of Bolshevik thinking about military force and the particular factions that exist within the Bolshevik Party. Because really, until the kind of the ban on factionalism that Lenin institutes at the end of the Civil War in 1921, and real kind of consolidation of decision making within the Politburo, there are a number of voices within the Bolshevik Party and a range of different opinions on things. So, following the October Revolution in 1917, for a period of time after that, the new Bolshevik regime is very poorly defended indeed. It has, for the next 6 months, three regiments of Latvian Rifles and the Kronstadt Sailors. And this, the Latvian Rifles number about 35,000 men. And then you have the Kronstadt Sailors as well. So this an army does not make. And you have, obviously, a number of well-armed and well-equipped and well-supplied rivals developing in the guise of the White Armies on the periphery of Bolshevik-held territory. The myth version, the fantasy version that the Bolsheviks created for themselves after the Civil War, was that their new army developed from the Red Guards, that these were good proletarian types who were motivated, committed, and passionate, politicised ideological warriors who were there to defend the revolution. And this is not the case at all. The Red Guards in 1917 are workers. They are groups of workers and soldiers, many soldiers who mutinied, workers who have left the shop floor and are really roaming the streets of Petrograd and other major cities looking for some kind of class revenge, some kind of payback, committing various acts of largely unsolicited violence. These are not guys who are in the employ of the Cheka during the Red Terror. They are a vigilante militia. They are working under their own devices very often and committing acts of terror against the now dispossessed bourgeoisie and really robbing, raping and looting a lot of the time. These are not the kind of people who are going to defend the revolution on the battlefield. And the priority for the Bolshevik regime is to get workers back into the factories as the civil war begins to develop. You don't want skilled machinists or people who can work a blast furnace wandering around the streets with a rifle. You need to get them back doing what they're doing. So they're pretty useless, really, and are when Red Guards are put into the field, are consistently routed. Trotsky himself has little time for the Red Guards. He is made the Commissar for Military Affairs and looks upon them as an ill-disciplined rabble. And this is not the kind of workers' army that he had hoped for. There are other voices on the left of the Bolsheviks that believe that it's questionable whether you need an army at all. Now, this sounds to our ears at the height of a civil war, with the negotiations to exit Russia from the First World War not yet concluded, and so with German forces on Russian soil, this seems kind of patently absurd. But the thinking is something like this. Many of the Bolsheviks who had seized power with Lenin in 1917, I beg your pardon, had long histories as members of the kind of the underground radical intelligentsia throughout the last couple of decades, of being arrested, being put in exile, and normally being manhandled by peasant soldiers. To them, the Tsar's army, and all armies really, were symbols of class oppression. Armies to the Bolsheviks are used for two things. Firstly, internal repression, you know, cracking down on to prevent revolution, and secondly, to wage imperialist wars, to throw, you know, the working classes as cannon fodder at one another so that the bourgeoisie can take new territories, colonies, and, you know, take their share of the profits, that kind of thing. So the question begs itself from the Bolshevik mindset, what do we need this institution for at all? Once the oppressive Tsarist state has gone away and Soviet democracy has sprung up, then surely we won't need an army to enforce anything at all. There might be some sort of, you know, revolutionary people's militia to defend the revolution, that kind of thing. But this whole army business, perhaps we won't need. This idea is swiftly dispelled and disabused as the realities of the civil war present themselves. If anything, Trotsky looks directly to the example of the Tsar's army to get inspiration and ideas. He's very much a not reinventing the wheel kind of guy on this topic. Trotsky's interesting because Trotsky's entire life up to the Russian Civil War had never featured any sort of formal military training at all. He knew nothing of tactics, logistics, strategy, and yet he makes a formidable military leader during the Civil War. So, despite his many failings, he seemed to be pretty damn good at that. From mid-1917 onwards, during the last summer offensive the Provisional Government launched against the Germans, the former Tsarist army had been melting away. When talk of land reform, a land seizure, was heard in the ranks, soldiers, who were really peasants in greatcoats, began to desert and to go back to their villages to take part in this historically unprecedented and probably once-in-a-lifetime process of seizing land from the landowners. This leaves, really, the successor state to the Provisional Government, the Soviet government, with very little to fight with. And unfortunately for the soldiers that are left, and really we're talking about the Red Guards here, Trotsky wants to kind of get rid of some of the more inconvenient aspects of the revolution as far as he, a military commander, is concerned. So what Trotsky does is he says to the army regiments, the spirit of kind of the committee within the regiment, that's gone. We are no longer going to be having a revolutionary democracy while we fight the White Armies. So much of the Soviet democracy that had developed within army regiments, particularly during the February revolutions and then throughout 1917, is abolished. Instead, formal discipline is reintroduced. Saluting, for example, the appointment of a proper professionalised officer corps and a hierarchy. And this was very unpopular. Again, there were already, even before they are compelled to do so, some 8,000 former Tsarist officers actually come to the Bolsheviks and volunteer to join the Red Army, perhaps for a number of reasons. These are men who soldiering is what they know. They were perhaps content for a career in the army, irrespective of their political masters, and they were some, particularly like Alexei Brusilov, who had been the general adjutant of the southwest sector during the First World War, and therefore fighting the Carpathian Offensive, which is also known as the Brusilov Offensive, the most successful Russian offensive of the First World War. He chose to join the Bolsheviks, to join the Red Army as a general, because he believed that if the Soviets were the, if this was the will of the people to embrace communism, then who was he to stand in the way of what Russia wanted? He himself was far from having any communist ideas and was essentially a victim of the communists. So at the same time that the rest of the bourgeoisie and the upper classes were subject to the Red Terror of 1918, you actually have some army officers who are certainly from that class background joining the army to serve the Bolsheviks. Trotsky, on 30 September 1918, passes what he calls the special order, which says that if the officers turn out to be turncoats, turn out to be traitors, then their families can be imprisoned and executed. By the end of the Civil War, there's 75,000 former Tsarist army officers in the Red Army. So that really does show how successful Trotsky was in recruiting them. They're offered superior pay.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Two ordinary men. They are respected. They are followed around by political commissars half the time, but their ranks are restored. And Trotsky accepts that this is one of the kind of the compromises of the revolution, that you can have an attempt to create an egalitarian society, but when that attempt is threatened externally, you actually need to have a hierarchical system in place in order to defend it. And it's something that can perhaps be dealt with at a later date, but you need to keep the revolution actually going in order to be able to do this. Trotsky does manage to paint something of a target on his own back as well. The problem that he has at this time is that he is not popular within the party, and that a lot of his enemies look very closely at the military successes, or lack thereof, of the Red Army. All of a sudden, articles criticising Trotsky start to appear in Pravda, and the step of taking Tsarist officers and putting them in the army comes under immense scrutiny. The summer of 1918 is full of setbacks, and whenever you have instances of Red Army former Tsarist officers retreating, or in one case actually mutinying, it's blamed on Trotsky, and voices within the party that say that, you know, some sort of revolutionary people's militia should be created, and instead of having well-studied military tactics and a kind of a hierarchy of an officer corps, we simply rely on kind of a revolutionary people's war and allow the passion that people have to defend the revolution to spur them on. The abandonment of this is obviously being some kind of folly. Now, Trotsky has a particular thorn in his side from Klement Voroshilov, who was a Red Guard commander, later to become one of Stalin's most prized ministers, commissars. And he becomes a voice in what is known as the military opposition. The military opposition are army officers, normally working class ones, who resent the arrival of the former Tsarists into the army. And they oppose what Trotsky has been doing. Voroshilov has the ear of Stalin, who is the Commissar for Nationalities, and, you know, one of the more important throughout the Civil War, one of the growing voices within the Politburo. And he is able to openly defy Trotsky with Stalin's backing. The tension over this issue, over the backing of Voroshilov, is one of the kind of the seeds of this kind of poisonous enmity between the two men into the future. If you go way back into the Explaining History archive, there's a whole thing I did on Trotsky and Stalin. Well worth a listen, if I do say so myself. For every inspired piece of leadership that Trotsky gave as Commissar for Military Affairs, he also created a great deal of animosity towards himself, partly due to his general arrogance and egotism, and also due to his Jewish origins. There is, of course, an immense amount of latent and not so latent anti-Semitism in Russia, particularly during the revolutionary period, and he is seen as perhaps the kind of the more noticeable, identifiable, dare we even say glamorous figure of the revolution. He is very well catered for on his mobile command centre, which is pulled by train across Russia. He is very well turned out in sort of immaculate uniform. And the ability of Trotsky to generate resentment towards himself is really kind of a key feature of his career. What he does do is he is able to propagandize effectively towards Russia's peasants. And when the Red Army, as we'll talk about in a moment, expands into a mass force of over 3 million men, this is crucial to the winning of the war. The Red Army under Trotsky definitely wins a propaganda war. The White Armies, the former Tsarists on the other side, who are really trying to turn the clock back on the revolution, they are unable to make clear to the peasantry at all what it is that's in it for them. That there appears, as far as the peasants go, that they are kind of trapped between a rock and a hard place. But the Bolsheviks do give the impression, though a false one, that there will be some land at the end of it for them. And also, once the White Army start to be backed by foreign powers, there is no pretense there that they are kind of in any way patriotic, whereas the Bolsheviks can clearly make that case about themselves, that they are some sort of patriotic force defending Russia, even if, you know, ideas about patriotism are a complete anathema to them. The decision to call for mass conscription really comes in the summer of 1918 when the revolution is surrounded. You've got the British in the north, you've got the Japanese landing in Siberia, and a whole ring of enemy Russian armies surrounding the heartlands of Russia, and the Czechs, the Czech Legion having seized the Trans-Siberian Railway. The key to winning the war is to create this vast steamroller. The Red Army never really fights particularly effectively, but in some battles it manages to outnumber the white opponents by, or some, in some battles even 10-1, by simply using enormous numbers of men, they manage to crush opposition to them. So the white generals and white soldiers outperform in most instances and outfight in most instances the Red Army in most key ways that you can look at it. Establishing conscription is difficult at first because there's no infrastructure in the countryside. The Bolsheviks literally don't have any of the bureaucratic knowledge needed to actually be able to carry out conscription meaningfully. And so they rely on the new peasant Soviets in villages. And the peasant Soviets are not particularly allied to the goals of the regime. The peasant Soviets are allied to the interests of the village. The mir, the peasant commune, simply in a new guise, change the name, but, you know, carry on very much as before. And peasant communes have never been inclined to send the sons of their members away to fight and to send good ploughing horses away to drag artillery pieces across the countryside. It's no good for anybody other than the people that want to really kind of exploit and use the peasants. And, you know, they're wise to this. So it was really a white-owned goal that forces the peasants into the arms of the Bolsheviks. Had the whites offered some degree of land reform, or had they said that the peasants could keep at least some of the land that they had taken during the revolution, they may well have won the civil war. But in the spring of 1919, as harvesting season was over, and you don't need to have any as many men on the land anymore, and the whites begin to advance, the peasants become fearful that the gains of the revolution are going to be lost. And so they pour into the arms of the Bolsheviks, thus enabling the Bolsheviks really to win the war. There is, however, another dimension to this. As the Red Army expands dramatically, The Bolsheviks lack the relevant food and infrastructure and production systems in order to keep an army on the march. And again, they return to the peasants with requisitioning and food brigades. As the peasants become increasingly reluctant to hand over their produce, so the policy of war communism has to be instituted. Now, I've talked about war communism before, probably about a year and a half ago. If you go to the explaininghistory.podhost.com, there's actually a way of searching for podcasts on there. So type in war communism and see what you get. So I won't talk about that now, but it is out there and well worth a listen. So the growth of this mass army to win the war really leads to all sorts of kind of social and economic and humanitarian crises later on, and the policy of war communism culminates in a famine in the Volga that kills approximately between 5 to 7 million people. Okay, so I hope that's been useful to you. If you're new to explaining history and you're studying the Russian Revolution or anything like that, there is an ebook out there, Top 10 Questions on the Russian Revolution Answered. You can find it through the Explaining History website, www.explaininghistory.com, and check out there as well. There's a whole bunch of stuff pertaining to Russia. Anyway, we just hit 45,000 subscribers this week, so a big thanks to everybody. I'm much obliged, and let's go on from there. Let's hit the big 5-0, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.